Thank you so much. That's good. Really nice. Yeah, we won't have this sort of kind of rocky music to get up here, but we just have to use the same stereo, so we just turn it down really slowly, and then everything's improvised. Thank you all so much for coming out to the Big Blue Door Jam. Yay, yay! Woo! This particular door jam, our theme tonight is law and disorder, and we have an array of unlawful and disorderly people to do some stories, so it's been great that it's been kind of disorderly, so thank you all for putting up with that. The artist here specifically wanted me to point out, that the jam and that little pedestal is on are not part of the exhibit. And also, I would ask you, please, there's this thing behind here that I will move the door at the end of the show. Please take a moment to read about the meditation, because he also asked me to do that, because he thought the door might keep people from appreciating the exhibit. So also thanks to The Bridge in general. The Bridge is a nonprofit organization that's based on volunteer effort, and we are so grateful that they put us here. Yay, yay! In this wonderfully chaotic mixed-use space that we get to share with the artists and everyone, we actually love the atmosphere. And there's a mailing list that's near the door. If you go out there and you can sign up to find out about other things going on at The Bridge. And they're also looking for volunteers all the time, because without volunteers, none of this happens. And enough about The Bridge. On to the Big Blue Door Jam! Yay! Before we actually start the official part of the thing, I have a special treat, which is that we have one of the graduates from our recent story show wasn't able to have a normal story class showcase because of some extraneous things. And so her story is kind of related to our theme of law and disorder. So this is not part of the official show, but we'd like to have her come up and just start out by telling her story, if that's okay with everybody. Even if it isn't. So, please put your hands together for Terry Long!
So, by the time I reach high school, I don't so much date as glom on to people. The need for attention started really early in life. I'm in a house of 9 people, and my mom is like, Kathy, Mimi, Paul, Jean, you know who you are, just get over here and get in the car. So, I didn't get a lot of attention from a woman who couldn't remember my name. So, I spent all my waking time up at my best friend's house up the street, you know, sleepovers and everything. And it's 4th and 5th grade, and I discover boys. And I'm boy crazy, so instead of paying attention in class, I'm writing their names all over my notebook. Dean and Mike and Jimmy and Chris and Darren Mitris. You know, they didn't really like me because I wasn't part of the popular group. But I had caught their attention in a certain way. I had developed early. So I'm using my looks and I'm keying in on their interests. They like Matchbox cars. I like Matchbox cars, yeah! So I go home and I steal a bunch from my brothers. And I buy a slew more. And so now it's me and Dean and Mike and Jimmy and Chris and Darren and Mitris on the asphalt at recess. And we're playing with our Hot Wheels, and it's great. Which, you know, soon became their Hot Wheels as I gave it to them to try to keep their interest. It's high school, and my grades suck, but I'm completely into getting attention any old way I can. And freshman year, I am caught parking with Bernie Mullertime, and the park ranger tells my dad that I have to get dressed before I get out of the car. And that is not true because my pants were on. Yeah. So, it's my 16th birthday, and I lose my virginity to Tim Thalen. I met him in a production of Babes in Arms. I was in the chorus, and he painted sets. And I was totally swept off my feet by his suggestion that we go, you know, hang out in the woods near his house. So, high school, and I'm not a student, and I basically flunk out of the private Catholic girls' school where I'm going, and I leave behind all the friends I've known, and I'm at the public high school, and I'm starting fresh, so I'm tagging along with a few of my old friends from the neighborhood. Good old Marguerite Downey.
Yeah.
But doesn't take. I flunk chemistry, and I have to take summer school, and I can't hack it, and I drop out after the second class. So I'm officially a high school dropout. But, you know, hey, it's early summer, and Marguerite and I are like, we're like, yeah, let's go out. Yeah, yeah. And, you know, it's right after graduation. Hers, not mine. And we're like, woo! So where do we end up? Drinking coffee late night at Hojo's. Yes, Howard Johnson's. The perennial orange and blue roof diner, 24 hours. Yep, yep, you got your ancient waitresses with their polyester uniforms, endless cups of coffee, and like glaring fluorescent lights. So anyway, we're psyched. We're being giddy, you know, 17, and we're in the booth in the back. And I spy these two guys with black leather jackets. And they are way too old for us. And, you know, mid-20s, and I'm like, so I'm game. You're like, I'm going to find a way. We're going to get over there. And Marguerite's like mortified. And I'm like, yeah, yeah, we're going to do this. So they're game and we're in their booth. Yeah. And the conversation is really out there. I mean, it's DC hardcore. And they're like into gory, you know, nasty fanzines and like serial killer Ted Bundy. And I'm like, yeah, yeah. And Marguerite's like, and I'm like, yeah, yeah, Sid and Nancy, I'm into this. So I'm with Rick, and Marguerite pairs off with Jean, and, you know, we kind of hang out every so often. Movies, Hojo's. I probably paid because Rick didn't have a job. you know, we had a lame go at it from the start. If we did date, it was, let's see, me buying beer and us, like, driving to some, like, deserted industrial neighborhood and parking, and, you know, me trying to get him to lighten up and, like, have a drink and look at me. So he tried to break up with me, but I wouldn't take the hint, you know? He wouldn't return my calls, and I get in the car, and I drive to his neighborhood. And I see him. I see his parents' car, and I'm at the door. Mrs. Mumford, is Rick there? And he's like, hey. And I show him the beer, and, you know, I come in, and, you know, we hang out for a while. So he finally got fed up with me. He's like, what's your fucking problem, Terry? You want to be like me, huh? Hang out with me? Fine. Let's do this. So we're in the car, and we're headed out of Fairfax County, and 15 minutes later, we're on 395 crossing the Potomac, head towards Northeast DC. And it's dark, and I can't say there were a lot of streetlights that part of town, and I park the car where he tells me to, and I open my wallet and I give him money, and he locks the door and says, stay here. And he's back in the car, and we're back driving to suburbia. And his mom was where we left her, you know, glued to the televangelist network in the living room. And the dad, I don't know, I heard he was drinking again and taken to, like, bunking at the law office. So we have the place to ourselves. And I follow him up the stairs. I close the door. Lock it. So he's at the desk, and he pulls out a bag. And he opens a drawer, and he pulls out the work. And he takes the spoon and carefully sprinkles the heroin on it. He flicks his pick. There's a syringe. But I can't watch any more of that. And he was nice to me. You know, random, highly mellow. He's apologizing. He's thanking me at the same time. And I'm just like, what bullshit. So I kind of take the hint after that, but not really. Fate intervened. And I am staying for 2 months with my sister and my brother-in-law up in Cambridge, Massachusetts. And when I get back home, I try to pick up with them. You know, hang out with Rick's friends and hang out with Rick and Rick's girlfriend. But yeah, yeah. But hey, I started a new job. So I'm working in this, like, little t-shirt shop in the lower level of Landmark Mall, and I'm sitting there, and I'm in a folding chair at the register, and I'm, you know, rinky-dink decal, iron-on decals are on the wall, and I'm looking out over the dusty shirts, you know, looking for customers or, like, you know, anyone to walk on by. And someone does, and he's tall, and he's blonde, and he's drug-free. And he's into, like, you know, industrial techno music. I'm like, yeah, yeah, yeah. So like that, I follow him home. Glom. Yeah. It's the very same day. Watched him, we went to his parents' house, and I watched him do his laundry. So like that, it's Goodbye, Rick, and hello, Brian. And I'm like, yeah, Brian. And Brian and I are doing everything together. And I live with Brian. And I marry Brian 3 years later. Divorced him 4 years after that.
Play along, everybody. So that was a good introduction to our night theme for the night, which is law and disorder. Hi, anybody here ever been arrested? How many people have been arrested? Stand up. Stand up if you've been arrested. Except for the person with the crutches on your camp dinner. We'll just assume you've been arrested. That's why you're in crutches. Stay up. Okay. Now sit down if you had to go to the police station. If you didn't go to the police station, sit down. Okay. Sit down if you didn't spend the night in jail. So everyone up here has spent a night in jail. Has anyone here spent more than 24 hours in jail? Okay, if you spent less than 24 hours, sit down now. Okay, and if you don't feel like talking about this, you can lie and sit down, because we won't know, really. Okay, so people up have spent more than 24 hours. How many people here let's just take it up a notch. God, not jail, but prison. Hard time. Anybody? One? Anybody else? All right, come up here. What's your name?
Drea.
Mm-hmm. Drea? And you want to tell us a little bit about it?
Prison?
How you got there, or whatever you want to say. We're living vicariously through you right now because...
Yeah, it was awesome. No. I was only in a prison technically for about a week. And I went there in a van load of a whole bunch of other people who had been arrested for obstructing, I don't know what, you know, the road in a IMF protest in Washington, D.C.
Wow.
And it actually was one of the coolest experiences of my life. I mean, it was,
wow.
It was very empowering because there was a lot of solidarity with the people there, and there was enough resources and viability of the group that we managed to kind of get ourselves out in a week and get our charges dropped. And
what was the facility?
I don't know. We were in Washington, D.C. So I honestly am not even sure what the name of the facility was.
Cool.
Because I wasn't, we had a law collective that was kind of dealing with the entire process.
And was there an organization attached to this?
I was working through a small group called the Buffalo Field Campaign that had gone just to kind of work with the, and I was also with the Montana Medics Collective. Oh. So we were doing some first aid.
Awesome. Awesome, Jay. So we're big on trinkets. The person who does our first section gets a handcrafted sticker using a laser printer, and so that's a very rare thing. Thank you so much for sharing that. And she's already folding it up. She's like, oh, look at this piece of shit. The keychain isn't much better. That's I made that with model paint and decals. So. I want to say tonight. So what's happening tonight is we're going to start randomly taking names out of the hats. We have a wonderful selection of storytellers. Each person will come up here. They have 6 to 8 minutes to tell a story. After about 7 minutes, is it Jen? Or 7 minutes, they're going to hear a little rattle, right? And as an audience member, it's important that every single person turn to the rattle so you freak out the person who's talking. The only point of the rattle is to let them know they have a minute, and then at 8 minutes, they'll get another rattle. We're never going to yank them off stage, so they may go after that. But there's also syrup panels of judges, which we the reason we have judges is only because we're too cheap to buy more than one jar of jam. So... We have can only give out one jar of jam, which we'll give to one person. And that person will then be invited back to for our kind of best of show, which will be sometime in 2013 when we get organized enough to get that done. So what the judges are sort of what they do is they just pick three people that are kind of their favorites, and then whoever gets the most votes gets this. So it's not a big deal. We don't take it that seriously, but we hope our storyteller. No, we don't. We don't. what the judge's criterion is it a story? Does it give you a sense of going on a journey? Does it feel in some way like it draws from the theme of Law and Disorder in some way or another? And does it use time well? So that's something that the judges don't have to take into account the rattle, but they're just going to, does it seem to drag in places? And the point again is that we're all just, storytelling is really a competitive thing. No, it's not. But anyway. The producer of our show is Jen Jones, my wife, and I'm Joel Jones. So thank you. So I'm gonna have Andrea pull out a name from the hat. And our first storyteller of the night considers herself to be more enthusiastic than most people she knows, which causes great embarrassment to her three children. See her November 19th at Live Arts, where she's doing a stage reading of Bill Ruff's play, Right There I Found Her. Right there I found
her. I found it.
Right There I Found It. Go. Put your hands together. Rosemary Harper!
And that was my roommate, Drea.
Yay!
Yay.
Yeah. Yeah.
Go for it.
Sorry,
you
took your name out
first. So there are a million and one ways to revolt against a self-destructive, overindulgent political and social system. Every day we hear stories of courageous women and men who put their lives out there to make the world a more fair place for us to live. I mean, if you listen to Democracy Now, you can almost be there at the front of the protest of the WTO, where there are gas masks and people are throwing tear gas and there's rubber bullets and there's riot cops. Julia Butterfly Hill, she once sat in a tree for 758 days, just so loggers would not cut it down. She affectionately called that tree Luna. And in the 90s, there was one woman that particularly struck me. Her name was Rachel Corey. She was a student activist in Palestine, and the Israeli bulldozers were coming to mow down the village where she lived. She went and placed her body on the ground between the bulldozers and the village, and she was killed. And I just remember that summer being so grateful for her sacrifice. Me? I stood up when a judge asked me to sit down in a courtroom. That was my gift to the revolution. I stood up when a judge asked me to sit down. I just want you to know that I was an activist. And there's something different about activist romance. So the real reason that I stood up in that courtroom, I mean, it could have been that I have a small problem with authority figures. Also, I'm kind of an overindulgent egomaniac. But in the end, really, it was just about boys. And there were two boys in the courtroom that day that I really needed to impress. And when you're an activist, you have to be a badass. You know, it's not about candles and romance and cards and going out to dinner, because in fact, you don't get to go out to dinner. You get to dumpster dive for your dinner. And you get to jump in a big green dumpster and have Hostess lemon pie squishing up between your feet and watermelons that are rotten and some wilted lettuce. And then you have to act like it's the best thing in the world. Oh, look, this is such a waste. My God, it's delicious. Thanks. Activist romance requires an agility skill set beyond my skill set. You have to be able to climb over fences, scale them, and then find a nuclear submarine and dismantle it with a household hammer. Activist romance means that you chain yourself to the opening of Monsanto. You stay there until your demands are met, and you have to wear an adult diaper. I really wasn't sure that I was up for all that. So when Judge Boyle, my bulldozer, my chainsaw, looked me straight in the eye, and he said, if you do not sit down, you are going to get 6 months in jail for contempt of court. I thought, oh my God, he is handing me my badassness right on a silver platter. I don't have to do anything. I can just stay right where I am. Because there were those two guys. So I did it. But who are those guys? Oh my gosh. Well, one was my best friend. His name was Jeff Winder, and we lived in a commune together where we served breakfast on the street to homeless people 5 mornings a week. Grits, oatmeal. We went to lots of demonstrations. We bonded over demonstrations. We demonstrated against the relocation of Section 8 housing. We demonstrated for public toilets. We demonstrated against the military-industrial complex. We demonstrated against binders full of women. We demonstrated against loose-leaf notebooks full of women. We demonstrated against spiral notebooks full of women, and then we demonstrated against pencil boxes full of women. And we bonded. And we were best friends, and we were just friends. And that was great. And he dated people, and I dated people, but in the end, I was his gal. I was the one who got the nitty gritty. I was the one all those other girls had to meet. And I liked it that way. But at this time, when I was in the courtroom, he was spending a little too much time with Tamara. And sometimes he was actually at Tamara's house when she wasn't there, visiting with her parents. So I knew something drastic had to happen. There was something I really needed to do to get his attention back where it belonged, and that was right on me. And then there was Tim Wurzberger. Oh my gosh, he was from California. He was from Los Angeles. He was an activist staying in our community for about a month and a half. And he lived on Skid Row and worked in an AIDS hospice and a soup kitchen. And I thought he was so dreamy. He had this brown wavy hair and he was tall. He was a little nerdy and his glasses were a little too big for his eyes. And I just had the biggest crush on him. And I am pretty sure that he had a crush on me, but we really hadn't gotten to that point yet. You know, it was just kind of still up in the air. So in fact, when Judge Boyle sentenced me to 6 months in jail, my first thought was, oh my God, Tim Wurzberger is going back to LA in 4 days and I haven't even kissed him yet. I'm never gonna get to kiss him. And they came and they handcuffed me. And they took me out of the courtroom and they paraded me alongside the courtroom where there was lots of media. And I flashed this peace sign behind my back like this. And I smiled for the cameras. And when I got to the jail, I realized my plan was not really very well thought out. The first thing they did was they took all my clothes. They didn't take my underwear, but they took my bra. That was really hard. And they put me in this orange kind of jumpsuit thing. And then they walked me down this hall. It was like the wild, wild west. It was like bars. It was a really old jail. And the guards didn't even have to come in contact with you. They could just like slip your food through the bars. And I got into the jail, and you know, there were these people that became my fellow cellmates, and they said, "Oh, we saw you on TV." And I was like, "Oh, yeah." And they were like, "Yeah, we thought you were a terrorist." So the first thing I noticed was there was a tile wall up against the corner, and there was a toilet at that tile wall. And it was a metal toilet, and there was a shower head. And there was no curtain. No, I hadn't thought about this. I was going to have to do my business in front of all these people. All I can tell you is that I did not eat a lot in jail, and I lost a lot of weight. But despite all those hardships and despite all of that, what I really have to say is that it totally worked. I started getting love letters all the way from Los Angeles, California, from Tim. I started getting love letters all the way from Virginia, from Jeff. I didn't wind up spending 6 months, but I did spend a month in jail. And I just, you know, want you to think about the next time somebody wins the Nobel Peace Prize, or perhaps you see a group of anarchists, you know, with a chain link fence pushing that dumpster right through the inaugural parade, or there's people in the streets going, "Whose streets? Our streets." But yes, yes, they could be all about social justice, but then I could be up here also, and it could be about art. But really, in the end, it's just about boys.
Rosemary Hubbard, everybody. Yay. Next up, we have actor, producer, writer. Currently with the Incredible Ridiculous Theatricals Company, and I need my glasses. And he was originally co-organizer of Wonder Comer and Shentai. Put your hands together for Jude Silvera.
This is a story about the time I accidentally broke into a church. It's September after college graduation, and I'm in Baltimore visiting my best friend, Pickles. It's 1 something in the morning, and Pickles and I are drunk. We're drinking 25-cent drafts at a charming dive bar. Having run out of quarters, we decide to go food hunting. Pickles and I are avid urban explorers. We love breaking into abandoned buildings and shimmying up drain pipes onto rooftops. As we're walking, we come across this amazing stone Gothic structure with a wrought iron fence surrounding it, a church. It's not abandoned, but it does have a series of peaked roofs, one leading to another. Pickles, we have to do this. Yes, says Pickles. We climb atop the fence, grab onto the gutter, and lift ourselves onto the roof. We walk a few feet and hop onto the second roof. Scaling this, we gain access to the roof above the sanctuary. It's made of slate. It is steeply pitched, 40 feet high. We scamper to its peak. Wow. I look down the opposite side, and at the foot of the roof is a stone tower, 10 feet by 10 feet. Pickles and I slide down the roof to investigate. We're facing a window composed of 3-inch square panes of leaded glass. We look inside and see a stone room. On the walls, sconces with candles. To the left, a small wooden table, 4 foot by 2, with a book on it. Beside that, a straight back wooden chair. This is the medieval monastery from Umberto Eco's In the Name of the Rose. We are very excited. This is a great find. But our bladders are telling us it's time to go. Now, there are no small roofs on this side to climb down, so we have to go back up the way we came. Pickles and I try walking up the roof, but our feet slip out from under us. We try crawling up the roof, but we keep sliding back down. For reasons known only to God and the architect, this side of the roof is steeper than the other. We have no way down. I look through the tower window. Surely there is a way out. I try the latch, but it's locked. Ye of little trust, churchman. I lean on one of the panes, and the glass pops out. Accident? I reach through and unlock the window. Pickles and I climb into the abbot's chamber. There is a small doorway leading to spiral stairs carved of stone. This is so In the Name of the Rose. It's pitch dark as we descend. The circular stairs take us a full rotation and a half around their axis before discharging us into a small anteroom. There are 2 sets of double doors, one on either side. These are massive wooden doors, arched at the top, hanging from large iron hinges. I look between the doors on the right. I see rows of wooden pews with the sanctuary beyond. It is hushed, somber, beautiful. Pickles, look at this. Wow. Can we go now? We turn around to face the other doors. I look between and see the churchyard. We are home free. I go to push the handle down to open the door, but I stop when I realize these doors have no handles. This place is so ancient, the only way to open the door is with a skeleton key. While Pickles and I are pondering just how it is we managed to not only break into this church accidentally, but trap ourselves inside of it, I hear a faint beeping. I look up towards the noise, and there it is, the one piece of modernity that has made it into this medieval wonderland, a motion detector for the burglar alarm. It is beeping. Its little red light is pulsating. We are screwed. Pickles and I dart back up the circular stairs through the abbot's room, out the window, and onto the roof. Oh my God, oh my God. I lay down on my stomach and look over the side. The roof overhangs the outer wall by a foot, and running down that wall is a copper drain pipe. It's a 20-foot drop. I grab onto the gutter with both hands and swoop down. I reach out for the pipe in my right hand, grasp it, let go of the gutter, and swing on. Hand under hand, I lower myself, right, then left, then right, until I'm about a third of the way down and the pipe breaks. I crash into the garden. I am unharmed, but the cops are on their way. I look up, and Pickles is hanging from the gutter. Pickles, you gotta jump. Is it far? Yes, but you gotta do it, Pickles, or we're busted. Seeing the wisdom in this argument, Pickles releases his hands. His right foot lands in the grass. His left goes further into a hole. He pitches over. I grab him, lift him up, we run the 10 yards to the fence, scale it, and make our escape.
Gene, everybody, woo! Now we have, I think, a first-time person here. This is, he grew up on a farm in Oregon. He boarded his first plane to attend Yale, and he lived in Antarctica for 5 months. He owns three dogs and horse and buggy produce. And you can check out horse and buggy produce at horseandbuggyproduce.com. Put your hands together for Brett Wilson!
I've been accused of being loud, but I think I just project really well. There's a difference. So if I'm too loud, is this
we'll
on?
Turn it down. It's fine. It's
good. Yeah, it's good. That's probably not too good. I'll just stand over. Can y'all hear me fine?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So everything he read about me is a lie. And when does 8 minutes start? Shit, I better start. Okay. So I didn't know about the theme, but I'm going to twist it into being relevant. Work with me here. So I'm trapped in my friend's basement for 2 hours. And the reason I'm there is not because I'm locked in the basement, it's because I'm scared of what's outside of the basement. I'm terrified of it. And when I say I'm terrified of what's outside of the basement, I'm talking about like knee knocking, sweating, palpitating, freaking out, hyperventilating, terrified. Not just your, you know, average terrified. And what's outside of the basement door that's keeping me trapped inside the basement, i.e. the prison, so I guess there it is relevant, is something that is, I calculated this, 11,000 times smaller than I am. Now, I'm a pretty big guy, and I've done a lot of crazy things, but this thing just absolutely makes me cower, run, and scream like a little girl. It's a little brown bat. And that's its official name. It's a species. It's little brown bat. I couldn't go for the big brown bat, which also exists in Virginia as well. I get the little brown bat. So I'm house sitting for a friend. I walk into the house through the front door. It's in the middle of the afternoon. And I walk through the living room into the kitchen. And I think I noticed something out of the corner of my eye. Set the groceries down. I walk back out into the living room. And it's that point that I think I wet my pants. Because I'm enclosed in an area with a fucking bat. My knees go weak, I go into lizard brain mode, fight or flight, I'm flying, I'm not fighting. And I see a door. Closest escape hatch is a door to the basement. I dive for it, I open the door, I go running down the wooden steps, and I compose myself, sort of. That's cool, nobody saw you freaking out. Little bad, everything's good, okay? Just go for the other door, outside the basement, you're outside, backyard, fuck out of here. I go to the door, I turn the knob, it doesn't open. I look at the door closely, there's deadbolt, which is only activated or opened by a key, on both sides. I'm screwed. So now I realize I gotta go back up and face the bat. Which I don't want to do. And so I start thinking about what this means and how I can do it, and I'm like, come on, man, be rational. It's like, it's this big, you're this big, you know, like, it's gonna bite you, it's like, and then I'm like, screw all the logic, man, because phobia isn't my logic, there's no logic, just, the bat. So I go up the staircase, and I really, really make sure that I open the door only enough so that a bat can't fly into my face and kill me. And I'm looking out into the living room down the hallway, and I see the fucker zooming and doing all that rad shit. And I'm thinking about all those stupid scientists that go like, you can string wire all over a room and a bat will never hit it with echolocution. I'm like, fuck you, man, the bat's gonna kill me. So I go back down the stairs and I sit at the bottom stairs, I'm freaking out for a while. I'm like, I do that 10 times. And finally I just go, God, this is so stupid. Get out of the freaking basement. Just get out and get this over with. This is dumb. The bat is not gonna hurt you. Just suck it up, man. Get out of the basement. Easier said than done. So that's it. The door's closed, and I just go,
what did that guy say? Like, you know, some historical figure. I'm like, I think Dan the Torpedoes was one of those things. I'm like, okay, I know that. Dan the Torpedoes. Okay. Close your eyes and think like Arnold Schwarzenegger and just get the hell out. Open the door, see the bag, go back in. It's not gonna happen. Good plan. I'm like, this has got to end. This has been 2 hours you've been out here. Get out of the frickin' basement, man. Get out of the basement. Overcome your fears. So I'm hyper, this is real. Like, I'm freaking out right now just thinking about the bat. This is not theater. All right, so. Grab the knob. Shove the door open, close my eyes, scream like a little girl, run to the front door, get out of the front door, put on the screen door, and I get on the yard, fall on all fours, I'm shaking like a leaf, and I'm hoping that nobody is watching me. Because I don't know what I'm going to tell them. You know, like, oh, there's a bat. Bat in the house. So, I'm there for I don't know how long, and I realize I got to get back in the house. So I go up to the windows, and I'm checking all the windows, and there's the bat. And if they just find a normal pattern that you can predict, then I think I'd be a lot cooler with it, but it makes no sense. So I wait outside for a while, and I'm like, okay, the bat's got to come outside. How do I get the bat outside? I'll open the door. So the front door, open the screen door, and I do that little slidey metal thing, you know, where the lock to the screen door is open. I'm like, okay, I should shove the door open, and then the bat will fly out, open the door, and get out of here. Okay, so open the door, I turn, and I run. I go across the yard and I'm like, oh shit, man. And I look at the house and I'm like, I had my back turned for like 10 seconds. I hope the bat flew out. Like, I'm pretty sure the bat, oh fuck. So I go up to the house and I'm looking in the windows and of course, I don't see the bat. There's no bat. But that's not good enough for me, so I remain out there for another hour. Waiting for them to see if I see the bat, and it becomes dusk, and it's like, I gotta go to bed, man. I gotta go to the house. This is so stupid. This is just dumb. Go in the house. So I go in the house. Slowly, needless to say, I go in the house, really. I go in the house, I come back out, I go in the house, I'm like standing in the doorway, I look around, there's no bat, there's no bat, there's no bat. And I keep saying, there's no bat, there's no bat, there's no bat. Bats could be anywhere. Bats could be like hiding anywhere. Man, they're little. They're really little. They can't anywhere. They hide behind things. So I go up to everything on the walls, and I press my pathos against to look behind all the mirrors and the pictures and now the fucking curtains and everything to see if there are any bats, because I don't want to move anything lest the bat get disturbed and start flying, and then, you know. I already wet my pants once, and I wouldn't do that. So I don't find the bat anywhere. Okay, that was outside. Out, it works, close the door. I sit down, I eat dinner, no bat. I go to bed, no bat. I wake up in the morning, I have my breakfast, no bat. Until this little voice says to me, you're not alone. Oh, you know how you have that creepy feeling? You know, when you're watching a scary movie and you just know, like, you're like, what the hell are they doing in there? Get out! Get out! So I'm sitting there and I'm like looking around and I don't see the bat. Everything's cool. And then the same little voice comes back to me again and goes, look up. So I finish that mouthful of cereal and I really reluctantly look and there's this old glass light fixture with translucent glass, kind of like would be in your grandmother's house, somewhat concave. And beyond the glass, I see this shape about 3 inches long, about an inch wide, and it looks dark, and it shouldn't be there. And I'm thinking, oh, crap. And I gotta know. And I gotta know that I can't live this way. So, this is like walls to the walls courage, man. I'm talking like this is like everything I got. I get up on the chair, I stand up on the table, I press my face against the ceiling, I'm trying to look down into the light fixture to see if that little fucking brown thing is the bat, and I can't do it because it's not enough of an angle for me to see down at the light fixture. So I have only one option, and that is to remove the light fixture and get this drama completely out of my life. So I put one hand in the light fixture, I take my other hand and I start unscrewing that stupid little nut that holds the light fixture in place, and I know damn well that it is the bat. I'm going to drop the light fixture and glass and bat are going to go everywhere, and I'm probably going to die. So I get it unscrewed, and I start doing the real slow lowering of the light fixture, and it's going lower, and I'm lower, bat. Oh fuck, it's a bat, 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 it's a bat. So I get down off the table really slowly, and I walk up to the door, and the door is open, and I take light fixture, I walk in the yard, and I throw the light fixture, and I run back to the house. Holy shit! Oh my god, the bat's been with me all night. And then curiosity makes me go, you gotta go and check, man. You gotta see. The bat is dead or alive. I don't know what possessed me to do this shit, but anyhow, I had to go back out. So I go in the yard, and I'm looking where the light fixture is. Did break, hit the grass, everything's cool, and I'm looking around for a little brown thing all over the grass. I don't see it, and I look further and further and further, and there's no freaking brown thing, there's no brown thing, there's no brown thing. This goddamn bat was alive the whole freaking time, and it flew away in the middle of the day, and I could have been killed, but the bat was there the whole time. It was alive, it was screwing with me. I don't know what it was doing, but it was gonna get me, and it flew away. I am one brave motherfucker. I just want you to know that right now. So I walk back to pick up the glass, and I notice a piece of paper. I pick up this piece of paper, and scrawled in this bad writing are just three words. That part was a lie, but everything else is true.
Well, first time storytellers get the keychain.
What's this for?
It's for your keys, but you probably don't know you.
Oh, it's a gift.
It's a gift.
Oh,
it's
cool. It's you shouldn't have.
But,
no, I'm kidding. Yeah. No, I'm not. Yeah. What do I do now?
The paint will be rubbed off by the time you get home.
I just pick a note?
Yeah, just pick one.
Okay.
I'll take it.
Cool.
Thanks, thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
Next person is another new person here, a local business owner, and he's a mediocre musician, he says. He's a father, but generally a optimistic soul. In his spare time, he likes to breathe. Put your hands together. Charlie Davis!
Thank you. Oh, this is much different with all those lights up here. So like you said, I'm Charlie Davis. I'm a local business owner and father, community member, supporter of the community. I moved here about 8 years ago, and I moved here from Rochester, New York. I don't know if anybody knows where that is, but I had moved to Rochester, New York in 2001 for graduate school, and I was going to work on a master's in history, and when I moved to Rochester, I'd never really lived in a big city before. Small cities, I'd been to a lot of big cities, but I had never really lived in one, and I was still, I think, kind of naive to the big city scene, and Rochester is kind of a medium-sized city, but it has a lot of big city problems. You know, it has a lot of poverty and a lot of drug abuse and a lot of unemployment, and it's just kind of a mess, actually, but good schools. And so I moved there for graduate school, and I started hanging out in the town, and maybe the first week or two I was there, I was walking down Monroe Ave, which is kind of a popular student area, and a man approached me on the street, and you've heard this story before, I'm sure, his story. He said, hey man, you know, just could I have a couple minutes of your time, you know, just not trying to bother you, but, you know, I just came in from the country, and I brought my wife and my daughter in. She had an appointment at the Children's Hospital, you know, I think she's got leukemia or something, he said, you know, some kind of horrible disease, and, you know, we got here, and now we're stuck, like the car broke down, this guy helped me fix it, but, you know, alas, I've run out of gas, and like, I just need to get the kids back to school and whatnot, and so, I sympathized with this guy, and I gave him $20. And so I gave him $20, and he was going to pay me back the next day. He's going to take down my information, and he was going to send it back to me. He was getting paid the next day, you know. And I left there feeling pretty good about giving this guy my $20. Although also feeling like maybe I may have been scammed. But I did feel pretty good at the same time. And, you know, it gets me to thinking that, like, you know, sometimes people do fall into these really tough spots in life and you just need a helping hand. And so we want to think that, and so we help people out in those situations. But I think oftentimes people create their own messes in life, and that's been true for me mostly. So the first time I smoked crack, it was no big deal. I had been in Rochester, New York in graduate school for a little while, and I partied a lot back then. I was at happy hour most nights and closing the bar probably every other night, and I had done just about every other drug up to that point, and I just happened to be, you know, closing the bar again, going home, and bumped into this dude on the street, and, you know, he just wanted to see if I had a lighter, you know, and of course I had a lighter, because, you know, I was smoking a lot of cigarettes back then, too, and so, yeah, I had a lighter, so I said, "What you got there, man?" And when a crackhead looks at you in the face and says, "This is the last fucking thing you should want to do right now," you should probably take heed. But that wasn't really my way. So I said, "No, man, let me check that out." And so, so I don't know if anybody knows this, but what you smoke crack out of is called a stem, and it is a it's a little glass pipe, which you can get at any sort of ghetto convenience store, and actually they sell these little plastic roses in them, you know, but you're not really buying the plastic rose, you throw that out. And then you fill this little glass pipe with a little piece of Brillo pad, which actually you cook first to get the chemicals off it, and then you push it into this thing, and then it operates so that you can smoke crack out of it. Well, I met this guy, and he showed me how to put the rock in there just right and get it balanced, because if you tilt it down, it'll drop the thing, and you don't want to do that. I've done that. That's tragic. you can't hold it up too high, because you'll melt it too fast, and then you won't get your hit. So you got to balance it just right and cook it, and then you can get a nice long pull from it. You wouldn't believe how how long you can pull that shit. I don't think I could breathe normally that way, but you can pull a crack pipe for hours. I did this shit with this guy, and I ran all night with him, and did all these crazy different things, and I don't remember much of it. When I got home to my girlfriend the following morning, and she said, "Where the fuck have you been all night?" And I told her that I had passed out in the parking lot next to our house, which I thought was a believable story. And she didn't believe me, and was right to not believe me. it's funny, I actually have memories of that, of actually sleeping in that parking lot, because I told that lie so many times to so many people because I didn't want them to know what I was doing all night. But I have this like false memory of sleeping in this parking lot. It's really, really, really kind of crazy. It's a strange thing what happens to you. It's hard to describe what happens to you when you become addicted to crack cocaine. For me, you know, I would be partying and say I wouldn't do that again, and I'd end up getting so drunk that I'd just end up getting high, and then I'd go on these 3 and 5 day binges and shit, and like disappear, and all my money would be gone, and I'd be like, "How did that happen again?" You know, and then every time I would say, "You know, that's not gonna happen again." You know, it's like I got this shit, you know, and then it would happen again, over and over and over again. I got pretty crazy. Life got pretty crazy in Rochester, New York. I was in grad school, so I didn't really have anything to do. I just, you know, fell apart. So, but the truth is, things got really fucked up. You know, like, You ever come out to your car in the morning, I don't know if anybody's lived in the city, and find that it's been sideswiped, and like all the cars on the street, all the way down the street have been sideswiped, and you're like, what the fuck happened? That was me. Those stories you read in the paper about the guy that tried to run over the other guy and commit murder and all that shit, that was me. So one time I'm actually in a crack house in north side of Rochester with the most disgusting people, you know, on earth, in the most disgusting place on earth, and I'm fitting right in. And in walks this guy that I loan this $20 to. And I said, hey, you're the guy that I loaned the $20 to, man. Where's my money? And he's like, I don't know you shit, man. And he was right. He didn't know me shit. You know, he was smart enough and smooth enough to get that money from me. And I got that at that moment. And, you know, I also got that he recognized me right away. You know, I don't want to diminish what happens to you when you become crazy. You know, I lost everything. I lost my house. I lost my cars. I lost my business. I lost my woman. I lost everything. But obviously I wouldn't be here, you know, if I didn't, you know, get clean. I ended up in Florida in rehab, and then I relocated here to Charlottesville, Virginia, where my you know, dormant crack addiction is looming over all of you people. But I often, for some reason, think about that guy, and I was just reminded of that guy the other day when I was walking down the downtown mall, you know, just doing some stuff for work, and this woman approached me on the street there, and she said, hey, man, can I just have a few minutes of your time? And I said, okay, you know, and she said, well, you know, just come in from Flavanna, and, you know, I got my daughter in the car, and I had to bring her to UVA Children's Hospital for an appointment. I've totally run out of gas, and I just need $20 to get home. And I said, darling, I've heard this one before, and this time I just kept on.
Come on. So, and we will read this one after the break. We're going to take just a couple minutes. So, if anyone needs to go to the bathroom or stretch or sneak outside and smoke crack, no. Thanks, everybody. Vaccine.